This is Views from the Watershed.
Part 1. Connected by Water.
I'm in my kitchen in New York City right now. I'm getting a glass of water. This is something I do a couple times a day. I don't really think about it. I turn the faucet on, water comes out, I fill my glass, I turn the water off. I drink some, it tastes good. A lot of New Yorkers do this every day, but in New York City, the meaning of the water that comes so easily out of your tap is actually very profound. That water has a history. Views from the Watershed will guide you through that history. I'm Lizzie Mogul, and I'll be your tour guide. I'm an artist, an educator, and a map maker. I'm also kind of a water nerd. I live in New York City, and I drink water from the Catskills every day. Why do I say that? Because 90% of New York City's drinking water comes from the Catskills, about 100 miles away and on the other side of the Hudson River. New York City is famous for having what's called the champagne of drinking water. It's clean, it's plentiful, it's cheap. It's supposedly the reason that bagels and pizza dough are so good. However, that great drinking water comes at a price. Let me give you a little bit of backstory. Starting in 1905 and ending in 1965, New York City constructed 6 enormous reservoirs, 2 huge underground aqueducts, and a bunch of other infrastructure in the Catskills. To do that, they used the power of eminent domain to move people aside. They displaced thousands of people living in tight-knit rural communities who had been living on and working the land, often for generations. They took entire towns, people's homes, businesses, farms, churches, schools, graveyards, and by many accounts, undercompensated people for their property. Even today, there is a lingering bitterness because of how people were treated and what they lost. In the 1980s, though, things changed, thanks to a little something called the Clean Water Act, passed in 1972. And then subsequent federal laws that compelled cities to make sure their drinking water was clean and safe. In order to do that, New York City needed the cooperation of Catskills communities. At first, the city tried to impose new regulations that would have made things very difficult for people like farmers. The Catskills communities were having none of that. For the first time, all of the towns in the watershed came together and they organized. They pushed back, and they pushed back hard. And they created a seat at the table for themselves, literally, at a negotiating table, for almost 2 years. What came out of this was a very thick document called the Memorandum of Agreement, or the MOA. This paved the way for a very different, mutually beneficial, collaborative relationship between the city and the Catskills going forward. The MOA recognized that the Catskills communities are important stewards of New York City's water, and that the city would pay them through grants and programs to continue to take care of it. This agreement was incredibly difficult to hash out because all sides, and there were more than 2 sides, had some very different viewpoints about what was necessary and what was right. They also had some long-held biases towards each other, but they got together week after week after week after week and worked it out. And this is because the people involved saw each other as people. In a way, this is about the story of the relationship between the Catskills and New York City, a relationship forged by water. This relationship is complicated. It started out very badly, but it's changed over time. And it's changed because people on both sides were willing to see each other as human, to talk openly with each other, and to compromise. And because of that, it's gone from an extractive relationship in which the city extracted water and value from the Catskills without giving much in return, to a symbiotic one in which the city and the Catskills work together and rely on each other. In a time where the effects of climate change are not just looming in the future, but they're here, this relationship becomes critical for both of these communities to survive. New York City and the Catskills are physically and socially connected by water. They're literally connected by 2 90-mile-long aqueducts that run hundreds of feet underground. But they're also connected because they rely on the same watershed to survive. A watershed is a way of thinking about how the Earth is organized, not by political boundaries, but by nature. All living things within a watershed are connected by the water within it, water which they need to live. It's a kind of community, one which includes trees, all sorts of plants, microbes in the soil, animals, birds, insects, fish, oh, and humans in the Catskills and in New York City. On the Views from the Watershed tour, you'll meet people who are part of this watershed community. They care for the water system and Catskills communities in one way or another. They are historians, farmers, anglers, journalists, advocates, water managers, scientists, and others. They all have different points of view on the story of the relationship that makes New York City's drinking water possible. So I hope you'll join us on this journey through the watershed.
Part 2, A Difficult History, featuring historian Diane Galusha.
This walking path along the Ashokan Reservoir is really a gorgeous spot. You've got the shining waters of the reservoir, the majestic mountains, the human-built and the natural landscape together in harmony. But we can't let beauty distract us from history. Underneath these placid waters are the remnants of 8 communities that were displaced to build this reservoir. The early history of the New York City water system is actually a traumatic one in the collective memory of the Catskills.
Water is the life force of any city. Without water, New York City would have literally and figuratively dried up. My name is Diane Galusha. I have lived in Margaretville for 30-something years. I wrote a book called Liquid Assets, A History of New York City's Water System, because I felt like we needed a resource for historical background for all of the changes that were happening in the watershed. The earliest water sources in colonial New York were springs and ponds and wells. As the population grew, these sources became contaminated. Garbage, dead animals, chamber pots thrown into the street, manure from thousands of horses. Also, pigs and other livestock were allowed to roam freely. Of course, fouled water and filthy streets were an excellent breeding ground for diseases. So there was a particularly virulent outbreak of cholera in 1832, and 3,000 people died, and a third of the population then fled the city. Another plague of city life, fire, took 700 buildings in 1835. The Great Fire took place in the middle of December. The rivers had frozen over. The fire pumpers could not get enough water to douse the flames. And of course, all the buildings were made of wood, and they just went up one right after another. And they just had to watch the city literally burn down around them. The city decided to look north to the Croton River to find a more abundant source of fresh water. So in 1837, the city began constructing this early Croton system, a 42-mile-long underground aqueduct, connected the primary reservoir, which was in the town of Cortland, to a holding reservoir in what is now Central Park. There was an above-ground distributing reservoir on Fifth Avenue, now the site of the New York Public Library's main branch. As the city grew, the network of reservoirs grew too. Between 1890 and 1900, the population of New York City doubled. City fathers were now obliged to provide fresh, clean, safe water to 4 million people instead of 2 million. So they began to look at other sources. From the early days, various proposals were considered for water sources for New York City. They ranged from building canals to harnessing the tides to damming the Hudson River and other rivers and piping the water across to New York. There were proposals to tap the Great Lakes and run pipe along the Erie Canal. The Adirondacks were considered, but they all had one thing or another arguing against them: distance, cost, the state of technology and construction capability at that time. Politics also entered the quality of the water. The Hudson River particularly was even in the 19th century polluted. And so it would have taken a lot of convincing to get people to drink that water. In the end, they settled on the Catskills. The Catskills is a water-rich, rain-rich region. It was also sparsely populated, heavily wooded, and trees are very good for water quality. In 1905, the state passed the law that was known as the McClellan Act, and that authorized the city to acquire lands to build reservoirs and aqueducts and other elements of the system. To do so, they were allowed to use eminent domain, which was the use of condemnation to take private property to construct public infrastructure for the greater public good. The city's allowed to basically take over an entire region. The local folks had no recourse at all. The writing was on the wall that they were going to have to leave in order that New York City residents have clean and abundant water. The Esopus Creek was dammed for the Ashokan Reservoir. The Esopus Creek watershed, the Ashokan Basin itself, had been occupied for thousands of years by the Esopus Band of the Lenape Indians. That area was used seasonally for hunting and fishing. They were then supplanted by European settlers who had farms, who used these copious water resources to run mills and other industries. They also capitalized on the forest by exploiting timber. By the time the Ashokan Reservoir was built, a new industry had sprung up, and that was tourism. The railroad had come through in the 1870s, and this provided a pathway for urban folks to make their way to the Catskills and spend their summers away from the stifling heat and the germs of the big city and stay in boarding houses, inns, and hotels. This became a very lucrative way for rural dwellers to make a living. So this was heavily impacted when the city came in and claimed properties. It was a shock to the economy. They had carefully cultivated these farms and boarding houses. This force from very far away was coming and saying, we want your land and you must give it to us. In the Ashokan Basin, there were 8 communities that were either eliminated entirely or partially moved to new locations. 2,000 people were displaced. That was a traumatic experience for local folks. There were generations of people who had lived on the same land. It was a disruption of history. It cut off the social and community development of an entire region. People were dispersed. Their neighbors were gone. Their relatives lived somewhere else. Many people did not survive this upheaval. Their lives were shortened by sorrow. There were stories of heartbroken people who didn't last very long after they were required to leave. In order for the city to claim land, they had to first pay you half of the property's assessed valuation. It wasn't a lot of money, and you could then negotiate with the city for a price for your property. If you were willing to accept that price, you could just take the money and leave. If you did not accept that price, you would then file a claim and hire a lawyer.
There was an appraisal commission appointed by the governor that heard testimony about the valuation.
This process took time. In the meantime, you had to leave anyway. It wasn't like you could wait until you got all of your money. You just had to leave. If you disagreed with the appraisal commission, you could then take your case to the Supreme Court, which took even longer, years sometimes. In the meantime, work was proceeding on the reservoir itself, and you had to move. The Board of Water Supply was very meticulous about keeping records about the condition of properties and buildings and such, who lived there, in order to come up with a valuation. They were bean counters. They were looking at what your house looked like. Did you have a broken window? Did it need painting? Was there a hole in the roof? Or had you let the property deteriorate? Not surprisingly, property owners valued their homes and farms in a much different way than the city did. You were looking at it as a place where you had lived for the last 30 or 40 or 100 years, and you didn't see any of those defects. You saw a place where you had grown up, your parents had passed, your children had been born,
and you had celebrated happy occasions and marked tragic accidents.
All of life had been lived there. How do you put a value on that? I think that was the biggest shock, having to ask for money for something that was priceless. The city hired the grubbing contractor, which was responsible for removing all of the buildings and all of the vegetation, for filling in the cellar holes, for filling in the privies, and basically making it look like nobody had ever lived there. There are stories of local men being hired by the grubbing contractor and being forced to torch or demolish their own homes.
Imagine what that was like.
The grubbing contractor would either auction the buildings or sell them back to the owner. That's such a perverted system that the owners could actually buy back their house, take it down, and move it somewhere. Even as the city was building the Ashokan Reservoir, it was anticipating the next move, which was the development of the Schoharie Creek as a reservoir just to the north of the Ashokan. The folks in Gilboa had been hearing rumors about this. People thought, oh no, this will never happen. But it did. The history of the reservoirs is basically history interrupted. There's no way to get back to that place where they were. It's the history that is so vulnerable to being lost, because who said? If we forget, we are doomed to repeat it. And I feel compelled to collect that history and preserve it.
Part 3, A Miracle of Modern Engineering, featuring Adam Bosch, the former Director of Public Affairs at the New York City Department of Environmental Protection.
This walking path along the Ashokan Reservoir is a great place to take in just how massive the New York City water supply is. And it's all managed by the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, with a little help from their friend, gravity.
New York City is fortunate to have a really high quality water. And it's known the world round. The quality of New York City's water is not a magical accident. It comes about as a result of planning and forethought. I'm Adam Bosch. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for the New York City Water Supply, which is owned, maintained, operated, protected by the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. DEP is the largest combined water and wastewater utility in the United States. Our job is to provide safe drinking water to New York City to support public health, economic growth, but also to collect the city's wastewater and treat it effectively. We also have the additional duty of managing and regulating air, noise, and hazardous waste pollution. We're the silent service. People turn on their water in New York City. It's there all the time. It's been there every day without fail. We have a perfect batting average from 1842 to 2021. New York City's water supply is the largest unfiltered water supply in the United States. 90% of the water goes to New York City without filtration because we do all the work here in the watershed to protect the quality of the water at its source. The water supply is enormous. It comprises 19 reservoirs and 3 lakes. When those reservoirs and lakes are full, the system stores about 570 billion gallons of water. That water is conveyed to the city through about 400 miles of large aqueducts. That water comes from a watershed, a drainage area that covers about 2,000 square miles, about 1.2 million acres. One of the founding principles of New York City's water supply is that all this water would travel from the mountains to the city by gravity alone. New York City is at or about sea level. The water comes from as far as 1,140 feet above sea level. We can use that difference in elevation to deliver the water all the way to New York City. The force of gravity is enough to push the water up into the fourth, fifth, or sixth story in just about every building across the city. Older residential buildings were built to that height because that's how high the water could get up in them. Later on, pumps were invented that could pump it up to a rooftop tower. Gravity is an incredibly reliable friend of ours that delivers water without the need for pumping, and all the electricity that comes along with pumping results in us being able to run an extremely environmentally friendly water supply system. The water supply is in three distinct and separate systems. So if we have an issue at a reservoir or an issue with one of the three systems, we can shut that one off until it clears up. There is an immense amount of flexibility. Not only can we choose which system we're drawing water from, we can choose which reservoir in each system, and we can choose at what depth in each reservoir we're drawing water from. We do constant water quality monitoring on an almost real-time 24-hour basis. Our scientists collect about 50,000 water samples by hand every year from the streams, rivers, and creeks that feed the reservoirs themselves, the aqueducts, and 1,000 street-side sampling stations that are spread across the city. We have this network of robotic monitoring instruments on the reservoir system through the collection and interpretation of massive amounts of data. We can make science-based decisions about how we are operating the reservoir system in real time. Ashokan Reservoir is a unique reservoir. The eastern part of the Catskills were carved out by the glaciers. The glaciers left behind a legacy of very loose sediment that lines the stream beds and banks. During storms, these streams mobilize that silt and deliver it down the valley. However, you are now going to build a gigantic bathtub in the middle of that. They built Ashokan Reservoir with two basins. As the Esopus Creek came out of the mountains, it would come into the west basin and it would sit there so that any sediment would have time to settle out. The east basin is where the cleanest water would live. There are four 15-foot tall steel gates in the bottom of the reservoir that we can open up to move water from the west to the east. Water leaves Ashokan Reservoir and goes into the Catskill Aqueduct on its 92-mile journey to New York City.
New York City's water infrastructure is kind of like your household plumbing, but a lot bigger. What happens, though, when, like your household plumbing, it springs a leak or needs to be replaced?
We are doing a lot of large projects to upgrade, maintain, rehabilitate all of the infrastructure that have allowed us to capture, move, and treat water for the past century. They all need some love, and that requires a lot of work and a lot of money and a lot of really keen science and engineering to figure out how to do it while you keep the entire water supply in operation. Many components of the reservoir system have been in service for about a century. We're doing projects to rehabilitate the mechanical components that allow the water to move from one place to another. The largest of those projects is called the Delaware Aqueduct Bypass Tunnel, the largest repair project in the 178-year history of the water supply system. The Delaware Aqueduct is an 85-mile-long tunnel that runs from Rondout Reservoir all the way to Yonkers, right on the northern border of the Bronx. It's the longest continuous tunnel in the world. In the 1990s, we learned that two sections of the tunnel were leaking. This was not exactly a surprise because when they were drilling this tunnel originally, They ran through some very problematic geology. Most of this tunnel was drilled through very dense, hard bedrock, strong enough to support the tunnel on its own. But down near the Hudson River, it changes to limestone, which is a very soft, crumbly rock. They lined that section with steel. The problem is that they did not go far enough with that steel lining. That is one of the few mistakes that should have been done differently when the system was built. So what ends up happening is over 50 years of service, all that pressure in the aqueduct, these little hairline cracks begin to form. The water from the aqueduct begins to come to the surface and show up as a little geyser in the Hudson River. The other problem was how to fix the darn thing. So we got together a group of expert engineers, and what came out of that was the idea to do the largest bypass surgery maybe in the history of the world by building a brand new tunnel parallel to the tunnel that's leaking. Then you would connect the new bypass, plug the leaking section, abandon it in place forever, turn the aqueduct back on, and the bypass becomes the new section of the tunnel. This bypass tunnel is 600 feet below the Hudson River. It's about 2.5 miles long, 14 feet in diameter. They're now making the preparations for this big moment when we are going to shut down the Delaware Aqueduct, really for the first time since 1957, and make that connection of the bypass tunnel to the existing Delaware Aqueduct, and then turn it back on. The Delaware system will only be shut down for about 6 months. We can manage the water supply in a way that people in New York City shouldn't even notice that anything is happening.
You can't see the Delaware Bypass Tunnel because it's underwater, but you can walk on three different recreation paths on or along the Ashokan Reservoir, including the Ashokan Promenade.
When they broke ground for the Catskill system in 1907, they were setting out to build what they called the greatest water supply in the history of humankind. They compared it to the great works of Rome, Egypt, and Babylon. And when you're at that recreation path, you're walking on part of the marvel of modern engineering.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Views from the Watershed.
This program was originally produced in 2021 as an audio tour in podcast form. You can get updated information, download the complete podcasts, and get a map and other info at
walkingthewatershed.com/podcasttour.